Yes.
The campaign for family dances.
Yes, yes. So when did you first meet her then?
Oh, that was in 1934.
I see, yes. And that was in the context of the family allowance movement, was it?
No, it was in the context of the what was called at that time, in its first name, the Children's Minimum Campaign Committee.
Oh yes, I think I've heard of that.
Title of it.
Yes.
It might have been Eleanor, it might have been Eva, or a combination of the two. One never quite allocates the pride of priority in the thing. But I always assumed that Eleanor. It was so called because the major campaign was around the minimum allowances and benefits of children, you know, from the Assistance Board.
Yes.
And but added thereunto, almost immediately, were campaigns of other sort of items, you see. Milk for pregnant women and children, vitamin preparations, school meals, and more ample school milk, and one or two other things of that kind. In fact, all that might be said at the time to embrace the nutritional conditions, nutritional well-being of children.
Yes.
Because it was quite evident there was a good deal of, if not absolute malnutrition, of undernutrition at the time, and probably a good deal of malnutrition. It was declared by some people that rickets were increasing in numbers and so on, you see, these other sort of diseases.
Yes.
This would be 1934. And about that time I came onto the committee, because there had been started another parallel movement at the same time called the Committee on Malnutrition. People in that were, I started it practically, may say, because I sort of got the idea, were Dame Janet Vaughan, who came head of Somerville.
Yes.
As you know. She was very interested at the time, she was medical, interested at the time in anemia, and this brought her onto the thing. One or two other people, Dr. Audrey Russell, I'm going to go into details about her if you wanted.
Yeah.
Professor Merrick, who was professor in London Hospital at the time. And other groups, sprang up in Oxford and Cambridge. Small groups of interested parties, don't you know?
Yes.
At the time, you remember, this was the 30s. The 30s was a period of increased activity. Political activity, and the 30s was associated with things like the, the Spanish Aid and so on.
Yes, and all the hunger marches. Yes.
And all that implied. Now, how far Eva was involved in that kind of thing, Eleanor certainly was. Eva probably was interested in the matter.
Tell you what she was involved with, she was involved in the Education for Citizenship. Lord Simon was involved with.
I remember that, yes. Lord Simon, yes, from Manchester.
That's right, yes. Yes. She was quite active, but less in the Labour movement.
Lord Simon, didn't he?
Yes, Lord Simon Wythenshaw, yes.
That's right.
Yes.
Yes.
So she was active in political movements. She was also head of Morley College, of course.
Oh, yes, I know that.
So she was quite busy, and having three children, she was quite...
Yes. It must be. And now, how old were the children at that time, you see?
Well,
Boydor.
Yes.
You know of Boydor?
Yes, I do.
And Garland Hopkins of Cambridge, head of the biochemistry department.
They're largely medical people, are they, or administrators?
By no means, because Eleanor, you see, was an MP, and she had the wit and the ingenuity to get together a kind of committee, which didn't always meet solidly as a committee, but it did meet in the House, with members from all parties in it. In it were, what's the name of the Liberal, Wilfrid? But one very prominent person who was connected with it was Harold Macmillan.
Oh, yes. He's involved with a lot of interesting things in that period, isn't he?
At that period, he was pretty radical.
Yes, I mean, he was a sort of radical Tory. I'm just...
Well, you know that, yes. He used to appear on our platforms.
Did he really?
Oh, yes. As chairman, anyhow. And he used to turn up at meetings. There were various other people connected with the National Council for Social Service.
Oh, yes. That's again quite closely connected with
Charles.
Non-militant suffrage.
Nursery schools and nursery day nurseries, those that kind of field.
Yes,
were on the committee. But this is the committee I'm talking about, for what was originally called the, as I say, the children's minimum.
Yes.
I think campaign committee.
Yes, I think that's right.
Now, it converted itself fairly soon. I came onto that committee and sort of linked it up with the committee called Committee on Malnutrition, which had started quite independently.
They both had independent origins, these two separate committees.
Independent origin. It was merely the coincidence of the common times we lived in.
Yes,
see.
Yes.
They had the advantage, or the sense, that they were campaigning for certain definite reforms, like increased allowances and benefits for children. Mm. And we're not talking about children's allowances or family allowances at the moment, we're talking about increased allowances in benefits.
Yes, I see.
And for increased school milk and school meals and the like, you
yes.
see.
Yes.
Whereas we were campaigning rather at large, but we overlapped, and however we overcame the overlapping by myself and other coming onto their committee.
I see.
So we linked the two together, and we never quarrelled at all about anything. As it went on, it became known as the Children's Minimum Council, because they linked to it, or drew the adherence, what we call it, of a considerable number of women's organisations, including the Women's Institutes, the Town Women's Guilds, with which, as you know, Eva was connected.
Yes.
The National Women's Council, whatever it is, and various other bodies of that kind. I don't know quite how widely they spread. I do know, I probably got the record somewhere or other of it, but the Women's Institutes are a little more cautious. They, so to speak, signed on the dotted line and agreed to support this campaign, but this widened broadly, you see, the campaign we had, and gave a much greater opportunity for lecturing and
publicity, sort of generally.
That kind.
Yes.
And meanwhile, various sort of subcommittees, various branches or organisations sprang up in different parts of the country. And as the peace went on, as the war approached, probably about 1938, it was decided more or less to fuse or to change the title, first of all, of the Children's Minimum Council into the Children's Nutrition Council. It seemed more suitable to make it quite clear what it was about.
Yes.
When the war approached, we fused the two things together. We had been getting out a kind of two-monthly bulletin, duplicated bulletin of articles of various kinds by different, mostly medical people, on nutritional matters, you see in there. And we continued that as the bulletin of the Children's Nutrition Council. And we settled down to re-establish it. Well, this takes us out rather away from Eva Havok, except that in the early stages of the war, we did come along, three or four of us, a sort of deputation to see Lord Woolton, who you remember was Minister of Food, and to discuss this kind of matter with him. He was very agreeable, and it was understood that the idea of making school meals more or less universal and compulsory in some degree, and making them free where necessary, as much as possible, and universal provision of school milk, that this was understood as being a very necessary part of creating the base, the food base for the war.
Yes.
And of course this did come into existence pretty soon, it's been understood, not legally speaking, there was no law passed, but in orders in council or something like that. Mm. Everybody was encouraged, in other words, to provide school meals, and the whole school meal thing developed very widely. Well, at that time, I moved just north of London into Hertfordshire and worked there with the Director of Education, a chap called, who became a fairly celebrated later, Sir John Newsom.
Oh, yes.
Who was the author of the Newsom Report. Mm. He died about 3 years ago. And he was Director of Education for Hertfordshire. So we carried out a sort of campaign of research in the schools there in one or two or three lines, and they published the material, and this was got round the country, so that was our particular contribution at the time to development of school meals.
So these committees that you were involved with up till the war, anyway, they're sort of pressure groups, are they, which try to influence local authorities?
Yes, they did. They tried to, pressure groups that tried to influence Parliament as well.
Yes.
Because, you see, there were members from all the parliaments, all the parties in Parliament, even if one or two, at least it was representative in that sense, or her organisation was. But apart from that, we both, in agreement with one another, used to hold meetings and to establish, where possible, local movements. In fact, towards the end of the peace in the 1937-38-39, there were springing up quite active committees in South Wales. The Children's Nutrition Council, Eva and Eleanor's particular thing, in South Wales, in Newcastle, Edinburgh, Glasgow, Leeds, and a few other places, you'll see.
So it's partly buttressing your private pressure with a public movement or campaign, really, isn't
it? Yes, it was, yes. Mm.
So you're really educating public opinion as well as...
Oh yes, it was endeavouring to do so by producing articles of one kind or another and engaging in lecturing around the map. And making use of any sort of opportunity that came along to do some publicity on it. I can remember that among us, hunger marches.
I certainly heard of them.
That is.
Yes.
Well, there was a woman's hunger march. So we had the bright idea of having a special meeting in London, Essex Hall, I think it was. And now, Lady Summerskill, or then Dr. Summerskill, MP, was in the chair, and I think there was Somerville Hastings, MP, and a few others, you see, speaking, but also three of the women from South Wales and Yorkshire speaking and describing to the audience what we hoped were a fair description of the conditions under which they were living. And this we got out, you see, as a report to the newspapers and so on, and got some publicity in that way. In other words, our aim was to use every opportunity that came along, that kind, to bring ourselves and bring our demands to the attention of the public.
Yes, I see.
Well, as you know, the in about 37, there were two organisations going, both under Eleanor Rathbone, I think Eva's patronage and support. One was the one for family allowances, which had never come into existence, you see. Mm. That was the older of the organisations, and I think it had been in existence since the mid-20s.
Yes, it had.
I may be wrong there.
Yeah, since the early 20s.
The predecessor of the Children's Nutrition Council didn't come into existence until 1934, I'm pretty sure of, because it was a parallel. It was paralleled all over the place by new movements coming up, you see.
Yes.
And at about 1937 or 38, they thought that the two organisations might be fused together. I was familiar with both of them, though I had nothing official or anything else, not any committee of the Family Allowance Body, whatever it was called, suggested they should be fused together since they were both dealing with the same kind of problem. But there were arguments against that were fairly strong. It was held that people, the mass of the public, would get them confused, that a great many of the trade unions, or leading trade unions, were rather suspicious of the family allowance thing, partly because it had been in France, I think, a matter for the industries to run.
Yes, I see, yes.
The family allowance. But by the coincidence of things, in 1946, wasn't it, the Act was passed.
That's right, yes.
Which allowed this, you see.
Yes.
And Eleanor had always, and I think Eva, had always been very urgent that if there was going to be a family allowance, a children's allowance, to be collected up for all possible children, that you could get the Parliament to admit, that it should be the mother who collected it.
That's right, yes, she was very keen on that.
Yes, very keen on that, and there was certainly almost a fight in Parliament, conflict in Parliament, but who it should be.
That's right.
She won her way there, did Eleanor, who was the MP representative. After all, Eva wasn't ever a member of Parliament, but the this meant that they... It was won through the women's rights.
Eleanor, in action, I suppose, didn't you? Doing this. She was a very forceful personality, wasn't she?
Oh, yes, she was.
I mean, she just steamrolled people into doing things she wanted them to do, didn't she?
She was never grateful, however hard you worked. You've never done enough.
What?
Eva.
We're talking about Eleanor,
Dan. Oh, we're talking about Eva. You're saying that for Eva now. That's very interesting. Do enlarge on that. I mean, you mean she was very demanding of people, wasn't she?
Very demanding. She wasn't... you couldn't exhaust her. But the thing that rather got under your skin was that you sort of worked yourself from 8 in the morning to 10 at night. And you've never done enough.
He's always making more demands on him. Mm. That's very interesting. Because, of course, I'll move this over so we get you on this as well. She was prepared to do anything for other people as well. I mean, in the sense that it works both ways, doesn't it?
She was the most generous person.
I mean, she would do all sorts of things for friends and even personal, small personal sort of favours she'd do for people. And she'd expect other people to do the same for her, obviously.
Yes. Yes.
But you first came into contact with her...
Over North Kensington. Yes, because my husband, Leonard Brown, was standing... They were both standing. They were the two candidates for North Kensington. Mm. And they both got in, but I think they both got out the following year. Mm. Do you remember, just what they called the Bacon Vote, when they promised the housewives... Cheaper bacon, I think, and then they lost the vote. I can't remember all the details, but I know it was called the Bacon Vote. And then
the
my husband
vote
became...
The what vote?
The Bacon Vote. It was something to do with the price of bacon, which upset the housewives. and so they voted for the Conservative. But my memory isn't, it's rather poor.
No, it doesn't matter the details, it doesn't matter. I mean, it's the impression she made on you. It's very interesting. I mean, what was she trying to get you to do, actually, Lady Clark?
It was canvassing. Door-to-door canvassing.
I see.
She And of course, canvassing in North Kensington, well, like most London boroughs, quite hard work. The thing I found hardest about canvassing in London was that you had this firm railing that you could reach the door, the next door, but you had to come down the steps and up the next steps. You see, this was you were doing a sort of herringbone the whole time, which made canvassing very tiring. I think everybody agreed about that.
This was canvassing for local government elections, the LCC.
This was LCC. Yes. But this was true of parliamentary elections. I mean, they were canvassing. But
you were canvassing on her behalf, were you then, as a candidate in North Kensington?
Yes.
How did you get involved in that?
Well, my husband was in the war, you know, right from 1940. He was an army psychiatrist.
First World War.
No, dear, the Second World War. Second World War. Mm-hmm. And he, after the war was over, you see, he'd been mostly working at the Tavistock Clinic and working with private patients. He hadn't really done much in the community. Mm. And he felt, I suppose he must have been about 54 then, and he felt it was time he did something for the community. And this was one of the things he did. He stood for North Kensington. Then he became an alderman and was with Eva, was on the educational committees. He was vice chairman of the special education, you know, for handicapped children, with Dorothy. Oh, I've forgotten her name at the moment. But I don't think on the LCC that Leonard and Eva were on the same committee much. I think they were another, because of course there's such a diversity of committees.
Yes.
But I think they both did a tremendous lot for education. You know, my husband, as a psychiatrist, he saw that a lot was needed for the deprived child. I mean, they were hardly considered.
Do you remember where you and I first met?
Yes.
Where?
At Mottram's lecture, wasn't it?
No.
Wasn't it Mottram's lecture?
Mottram's lecture?
Yes, Professor Mottram.
Lecturing for
you. He was talking about nutrition.
I mean, she was, as a Jew, Jew by birth anyway, she was active in that, wasn't she?
She was, yes, and I don't know, I think the details are given in her life to some extent.
Yes, they do.
I think they're mostly concerned families, family members or remote members of the family, did they not? I'm not sure.
Well, she certainly did, yes. Was in
but
Belgium,
that was a period of time, well, I suppose, dating from 34, you know. Must have been somewhere about the same period, because at that time, or 33 or 34, there were numbers of Jews coming over here, and
various
organizations were started about relief of the victims of Nazi Germany or something like that, you see.
One of the things I want to ask you was she obviously Jewish in appearance or in connection?
Well, I don't know if she was.
Yes, she was in appearance. She had very fine features, rather pronounced nose, but a very fine face. And then she had this rather fuzzy hair.
That's right.
Thick hair. And of course, she was, in her appearance, very untidy. I think she always had been. She'd been brought up with nurses and things. Never did anything for herself. I think everybody thought of her untidy.
When you say untidy, you mean she didn't bother to have her hair neat? Or...
No, her hair was sort of always, you know, really rather rough. And her clothes, you know, she sort of threw them on. She just sort of... Well, these things didn't matter to her.
Yeah, I mean, that's absolutely right. It all springs from her values, really.
Yes.
Which she has a hierarchy of things that are important, doesn't she? And clothing is not important.
And it must have been rather trying for her mother, because I think her mother was a very conventional and very precise and...
That's quite right.
A beautiful woman.
Yes, a sort of upper-class philanthropist type of person.
Yes.
But she could look, according to her daughter, she could look very nice in her clothing if she took the trouble, but she never did bother much.
I know in the book it says that after her husband died she wore black, and she'd never worn black. She always wore colours.
Did she?
Yes.
I don't know.
But I can't remember. I have a feeling that she...
You say she's born about 1886, and did she know anything?
Right.
I don't know if she's mentioned in any of the early histories of the Fabians.
I don't think she was ever very prominent. I mean, she just mixed
probably
in those circles.
Not, no.
I mean, she, Ben Keeling and people like that she knew very well, and of course Amber Blanco White and
A
number of people who later became more active.
Yes.
Of course, with Eleanor Rathbone, she was very friendly, wasn't she?
Yes, and did you actually see, I suppose you were too late to see Eleanor.
No. I heard her speak on many occasions.
Did you really?
Yes. And I remember her saying at one of her meetings, somebody had said, "Do you believe in politics?" And she replied, "Do I breathe?" And this always stuck to me, because it was a very significant thing to say. I mean, she was really just sort of summing up politics in the real sense of politics, wasn't she?
Did you come to the memorial meeting, the memorial lecture to Eleanor Rathbone here in Cambridge? No. In Oxford?
No. Because I was in London then.
Well, yeah.
It wasn't just Leakey, was it?
Well, when was it? This is one that
I'm sure. I don't think I did come to her memorial.
Well, somebody found in a memorial lectureship to see if Ellen Rathbone. Now, she'd been member for the joint or combined or associated unit.
Rather slender.
Was she really?
Oh, because no. I don't think so. She's a very solid person. I don't know.
Yes, I have the impression she rather carries all before her. I mean,
oh,
she's
she did,
so sweet.
Yes.
But perhaps did she shrink a bit when she got older?
I don't honestly know.
No, but no, my impression was that she was. Because certainly Eva was a robust figure.
Yes, she's quite stout, as they say, wasn't she? I mean,
she was,
in the later years. Yes. What was she like in from the point of view of getting things done? I mean, she clearly swept you along, didn't she, and made you do things. Yes. She had that.
To Eleanor or Eva?
Eva now.
Eva, yes.
What were her methods in working with people? I mean, can you remember anything?
Well, she was very cut and dry. She knew exactly what she wanted done. Of course, my association was only with the election when we were all head up and working very hard and feeling it was a losing game. And she certainly was full of plans and very organizing. I mean, I think her plans were very good, but she expected more than was possible from people. And her plans, she was very frustrated if we didn't achieve at the end of the day what she sort of set out for us to do.
So how would she let you know she was frustrated? Would she actually get into a rage or something, or what?
Not exactly. Into a sort of fuss, into a fluster, and she'd sort of dash off and do something that which somebody else had omitted to do. But I remember her daughter saying, "Mother just wears me out." She just wears me out.
Which was this, Diana or?
I can't remember which daughter, but I can remember that she was also thankful when she could get out into the field herself and let Eleanor look after the children. Because she felt she got on so much better without her, without Eva. Mm. I can just say, this is a picture I've got quite vividly in my mind, this poor exhausted little thing, mother wears me out.
It's probably Diana, I should
think. Rather, if anybody contradicted me, but I don't think they would. I think it's quite cool.
No, that fits with everything I've been told by other people. But there's an odd contradiction here, isn't there? Because Eva is well organised in terms of campaigning and doing political things, but disorganised in her personal appearance and her personal life, in a way, isn't she?
Yes.
I mean, she's always late, for instance.
And it says in the book how when a committee was later, or it was going to be held up for half an hour, she'd dash off and do something else.
That's right.
And keep other people waiting.
Yes.
Well, it's a waste of time, isn't it?
Yes, it is. I mean, it's a pity your husband's not here in a way, because one of the great strengths of Eva is that she was good at working with men, I believe. Yes. I mean, that she didn't have that rather prickly quality of some feminists of only being prepared to work with other women and so on.
No, she had a very charming way, well, really, you know, with them. Apart from what I've said about the not canvassing enough. But I mean, in her social relationship, she was very charming to women, but I think she did get on. She had a special gift of getting on with men.
That's quite
because
right.
Because my husband didn't really like what he called bossy women. But he got on with them. There was a certain member on the LCC, and she had a special expression. I'm livid. I can't think of her name at the moment, but she would come into the committee room and say, I'm livid. And he used to make a great point of getting it out before she did. Say, I know, you're livid.
And, I know,
Leonard would say to this, I can't think of her name at the moment.
She wouldn't be Margaret Cole, would it?
No, it wasn't Margaret Cole. Margaret Cole were very good.
Said she was livid, would she?
What?
Margaret Cole.
No, she wouldn't have. She wouldn't. Her name will come to me in a minute. I can see her.
That period, no doubt, had preliminary mornings of this kind of thing happening. I've seen it. Charles Hogmins, and Professor Hogmins.
Oh, yes. Political arithmetic.
Got out the thing. Mm. And I don't think she felt much one way or the other, nor did I. I thought, well, considering the size of the population, the sooner it stabilizes, the better for us, considering our position in regard to food imports and all that kind of thing.
Yeah.
It was about that period, or a little later, that I started on Penguin myself, called Our Food Problem, which again dealt partly with the problem, but partly with the possibility of the oncoming of a war. But then, I don't know why she took it up. I never knew what the connection was in the minds of Eva, but I think it was very common, very widely spread sense of unreasoning apprehension about a declining population, which touched people from Churchill downwards, who made announcements or pronouncements in a small way about it, or were recorded as having said this or that on the matter, I think, and various of the journalists in different papers were writing on the subject about that period, I think. This is when she wrote. I don't know what her own motives were, and I don't know why people were bothered about the
population.
Didn't worry me in the slightest.
No, I mean, I suppose it's partly a military reason, isn't there? That first of all,
that was the reason at that time, just the apprehension of a possible war. Mm. Nobody calculated exactly how many human beings we wanted, and the idea of decline in population always alarms people, you know.
Well, it did then. I think it does so less now, does it? I mean, we're now conscious of the discomfort involved in having large groups living in towns and all that stuff.
We are aware of it now. We are. We wish we could stabilise the population at about 30 million or something like that. It would be convenient, probably. We could manage perfectly well on that.
Yes. This is the beginning of the war, is it?
Yes, after about a few months of the war.
Yes.
See if we could re-establish it. And I got all the subscriptions that I needed to set going on the thing. So whatever it was per year at that time, we got a basis in which we could duplicate the material. So we just kept it going. The Children's Nutrition Council therefore remained in existence throughout the war, until after the war. I never consulted, to my memory, Eva about it. Mm. Eleanor was prepared for this kind of thing to carry on in a somewhat personal way by me and one or two others, simply because it was so difficult to communicate with one another or to get together. We were living in separate parts, you see.
During the war, this is all, or anyway.
Talking about the war. No, yes. Before the war, we could easily get in touch with another telephone or go down and sit in committees. And sometimes committees were held in the House, in a committee room in the House of Commons. Mm. A few people gathered together. And
What happened after the war then? Did the government assume these functions itself? I mean,
no, it didn't. In the Ministry of Food, still there, you see. The Ministry of Education was really responsible for all the school meals and school feeding, that kind of arrangement, which was the particular interest. I suppose.
Because what seems to me to happen in this is the 1946 Act.
1946 yes. Act. And the provision of family allowances, children's allowances. And the children's allowances were to be collected from the post office by the mother. Or once this had been completed, you see, those of us who were concerned in it felt that at least that period of work was over. There was no point in carrying it forward yes. very much further. We did continue for 1 or 2 years, carry on sending out an occasional bulletin or news sheet or something like that to members. And then 2 or 3 things happened. We decided to close it up altogether. We got together people who were concerned in it. There was a treasurer. What was his name? Sir Evelyn Howard or something like that.
Oh, yes.
And he agreed that we'd close it up and we'd transfer any balance that remained in the whole thing, not a very large sum, of course, for that time, to some other cause. I forget what it was transferred to.
Yes.
I rather think to a new organisation that was some of us established. Some of us were looking round for new fields, Conquer. So we established a thing called the Council for Children's Welfare, which is concerned, generally speaking, not so much with the nutrition, but with the general welfare of children. I think its first campaign was on horror comics.
Oh, yes.
And the attack on horror comics in the same way. This gathered quite a deal of, for the time being, of modest support, generally speaking, and we'd collected enough money to go on with it. But it can, this would have been, you see, in 1950. When did she die?
She died in 1950, actually, yes. So she wouldn't be involved.
Yes, she wouldn't be involved. It was in 1952 it started. Mm. A chap called Simon Yudkin.
Oh, yes.
You know him at all?
Yes,
child,
I do.
A child specialist.
Yes.
He died about 10 years ago, I suppose, 8 years ago now. Rather prematurely. And there was quite a galaxy of people connected together in it, and we set going on this new plan. And I think we transferred by agreement with the members of the old committee, such as we could collect together, we agreed to transfer the small balance starting this new thing, you see.
Could I ask you, I mean, this may seem to you a rather naive question, but what makes you tick, so to speak, all you people who are active in these causes? You haven't got anything personal to gain from these things at all, have you?
No.
It's not a religious faith, I imagine, is it, that motivates you? I mean, is it just that you have a humanitarian concern, which is activated by seeing poverty all around you, or something like that. I mean, can you explain your...
Not necessarily just your personal position,
but the general impetus behind these things?
Well, you know, it is religious in the sense that it isn't attached to any particular religion, but there must have been inherited in humankind since early days, perhaps, in history, something of a stray that turns up in individual people, of a desire to save the world, and to save perhaps only a part of it. I remember being connected with various relief bodies, and certainly being very much connected with the refugees from Germany in 1934, in that period. But before then I'd been connected with various interests, and I already knew people like Boyd Orr and others. As far as I'm concerned, what makes me tick, what might take it would make many of the women tick, would be the identifying of a certain sort of cause as being one of the most important. In this case, you see, food, obviously, the most important of all things. We can just survive, but we must have food to eat.
Yes.
And throughout the period, and throughout the war, and especially at the end of the war, I was very much concerned in organizations of relief in other countries, you see, you know, food relief and so on. And during the war, or before the war, in the Spanish Civil War, I was concerned in food relief in Spain.
Were you?
The
yes.
Democratic side, yes.
See, I wonder whether
all these things, you see, one was inevitably drawn into these different kind of causes. Once one had set oneself this kind of thing.
Yes.
And don't want to go into details about myself, but I would suppose that Eleanor and Eva, do you see, were stimulated by much the same thing. Now you say they were definitely strategists, I would say. Eleanor and Eva together, probably Eleanor was the initiator of the idea that if there were going to be children's allowances, they must be paid to the mother. This meant that she established the mother, the housewife, the mother's right to an income of her own, however small.
That's right.
It was the first move made in that direction. Mm. And Eva, I think, accepted, even if she didn't initiate, this idea. It all links up with the Fabian sort of approach and with the feminist approach.
Yes.
The fusing together of the two, as it were.
Yes.
And the foundation of the Fawcett Society, with all that that implied, and the history of the Fawcett family, or whatever the families were that had been in existence before that,
the Garretts.
Garrett Anderson,
yes.
The Garretts, yes, the Garretts, and Garrett Anderson, of
yes.
course. Certainly, as far as I remember, there were members of all the parties, especially through the instrumentation of Eleanor, I think, who was after all placed in a fairly good strategic position in the House to be able to approach these different people and to get people to join her in the thing. What other movements there have been of the same kind in the House, I can't remember any that exists now that are parallel, but then they may be hidden from me. In this case, it wasn't exactly a coalition, but it was a coalition of minds. Of people from different organisations, you see, different parties.
Yes.
Wilfred Roberts was the man, the Liberal.
Oh, yes, yes.
He was a fairly prominent Liberal at the time. I think he must be dead now, I don't know. I haven't heard from him for a long time. But he's pretty active among the fairly, well, comparatively smaller numbers of Liberals at the time. But there were one or two people who would, I suppose, esteem themselves to be conservatives.
Including
as I said, Harold Macmillan.
Mm. Was he actually very active, Macmillan, in this?
Well, he used to speak on the matter. He used to come onto platforms, certainly agree to take the chair at a meeting to be addressed by usually doctors and scientists, you know.
Yes.
At a meeting would be held at some modest hall, keep the thing going, something like they call the place, the one or two places up in Holborn, I remember, and if you know the people, looking for, if not a leadership, at least a goal that they might conscientiously aim at. There were numbers of scientists, you see, who would not have attached themselves openly to a Communist Party or even a Labour Party, possibly, but were prepared to throw themselves into these kind of objectives, you know? They possibly would have called themselves radicals or leftist or something like that. I dare say a good many would have, but certainly they survived all over the place and one found them really existing in groups in different science departments and universities and things like that, you see. I mean,
they're not people who are interested in politics for its own sake, but they're interested in causes that require politics to be successful.
One would suppose so, but you see, in those days there were several causes. There was the danger or the certainty, or the growing certainty that there would be a war. There was the Spanish Civil War, there was the Ethiopian, Abyssinian War, at the advances of the Italians into Canterbury at that time, Temple was quite important because while we're going in full speed then, the, what was it called at that time? It wasn't called the National Council of Adult Education. It was called the British Council or British something of Adult Education. It only matured into being its present size and importance after the war. But it was then National British Council, I think, of Adult Education, decided to get out a special number of its quarterly journal devoted to nutrition matters. So they asked me to come along, we discussed it, and I got a whole number of writers for it, you see, and we dealt with different subjects. I think it was not too bad a product. I don't know how they managed to do it financially, but they did. And the whole thing was introduced by Temple, a very good article by Temple, I remember, at least it struck me at the time. And there were others, people, I don't know that there were many leaders of the church who could be brought into it, though I dare say could have been encouraged to it. I should have to drop my mind back into remembering whether any were involved in, say, places like Birmingham. Or... Now, this is what I was doing on the whole. I didn't think I wasn't employed in a job. I had enough income myself to get on with.
I see.
I was married and I lived in the middle of London. I lived, if you know London at all, I lived just in the village that you might call Holborn, just behind Holborn and Southampton Row.
Oh, I know.
Private income, hadn't you?
Yeah, I'm sure she had, yes. And so Eva? That's two of you. Eva was employed at Morley College, of course.
Yeah, of course, she was at Morley College.
Yes, so she
yes,
had...
Yes, well, there, you see, that's the important thing, to find out how she managed so to arrange her work there,
yes,
and so to subordinate the work with other people, to allow herself some freedom for getting on with other things. Timing.
Yes.
You must start early and begin to get the thing going and get it onto legislation if possible, even if you don't expect the legislation to be very effective to begin with. You can give instance after instance of this, you see. It was observable, for example, when they first of all had brought in the Act 1908 for the inspection of school children, medical inspection of school children.
Yes.
You see? This was felt by, or said to be felt by, a number of parents to be an intrusion upon privacy, don't you see? That you had this young medical officer at the school looking at all the children and reporting back and giving advice on the matter. And it took a bit of time before the parents could be persuaded to, the children were looked at, but what they wanted was the presence of the parents as well, don't you see?
Yes.
So it took a bit of time. There's another example. It took a bit of time, but it took a generation. But once the generation was over, it got broken into to some extent, and people were prepared to come along. And another example is this very matter of the children's allowance, the family allowance, don't you know?
Yeah.
We've been talking about.
Yeah.
And
you get some sort of legislation enacted, and however inadequate it is, you've got the thing in motion.
Yes, you've got to get the right legislation to start with. Now, what has happened here is becoming a matter of a topical politics in a small way, because there are groups of people that I'm connected with still working on this kind of thing. The people who produced books on fatherless families.
Yes.
And the like. I don't know if you have touched that.
Well, certainly they are much more prominent in the news now. Than
that was Margaret Twain. But this is apart from the fatherless of the nature of the family.
Yes.
The question was the health and nutrition, especially nutritional levels, of children in the embryonic stage and in the first so many months of life. The vital period when the central nervous system is growing most rapidly, perhaps, and so on, you see, and integrating itself when it's so necessary to do this kind of thing. Now, what are we going to do about it? Unfortunately, we introduced the idea of the mothers
going to the post office to collect the money, you see. But the Finns had the common sense, when they introduced family allowances, to have the money given out at the maternity and child welfare clinics. So you've got them.
Yes.
They've got to go along there to get the money, and so you've got the child there, or the pregnant mother, for, if necessary, examination, discussion, and advice, and the rest of it, you see. The result is that their infant mortality and their neonatal mortality is much lower than ours is by this time. And the French didn't know quite what to do about it, but they introduced a sort of supplementary family allowance established in the same kind of way. But our people are hesitant about it. They say, well, once you've got people into the habit of going to the post office to collect the money, and you introduce a quite a new system, everybody gets suspicious and yeah. wonders what is at the back of it, yeah. and whether there's some dirty plan.
So it's a new vintage. I'm a Victorian, and after the First World War, I think we all felt that we really had got a job to do, that we were trying to sort of repair the damage, and we really believed in progress. And you see, we don't really today believe in progress. We sort of just believe in trying to put one foot in front of the other.
That's quite right. Yes, I mean, you see, Eva, there's no doubt that Eva
was in Regent's Park, and we walked in Regent's Park, and the children were all ragged and underfed, and you know, and they for their tents were an old sacking, and they tied it to the railing. And my daughter, when she was about six, she said, why do these children wear ragged clothes? Why don't they wear good clothes like we have? And I mean, I always feel that we don't appreciate enough how this feeling is passed on, even through children, this feeling that it's unjust to wear ragged clothes, or unjust to be...
Yes.
Do you think that is, yes. or do you get rather far-fetched?
No, it's unjust.
It's a question of how you've got to solve the problem. And your children could have gone short of certain clothes in order to distribute the things more evenly.
Well, they did, of course. I mean, their clothes were.
I mean, this is the answer, one answer, anyhow. The organisation that succeeded the Children's Nutrition Council, the Council for Children's Welfare, which carried forward into it a few of the people who had been loosely attached to the other one, don't you know, but it had much broader ideas. And I remember pointing out how important it was in the Children's Nutrition Council, and its, it changed its name, of course, from 1934 onwards, that it had always been associated with definitely five demands, all obtainable. Provision of cheap milk and vitamin preparations to pregnant women and young children. Quite possible to do it, you know.
Yes.
Just a matter of...
And so you focus your campaign on limited, specific and practicable objectives.
Not enough. The organisation that developed in the Council for Children's Welfare would not attach itself like that to a series of definite demands and plug away until it got these demands granted, as we did, you see, in the Children's Nutrition Council. That was some advantage there, that we could do that. Mm. But I think that nowadays, I think this is one sort of lesson of the Fabian methods, if you call it that, of the strategy of organisations. Go for something that can be made definite, that can be obtained, and that can be made the basis or the foundation for further advances, you see, like family allowances, for example. Quite an easily definable thing, that gradually, as Eleanor went on working and her associates in the house, got more and more support, more and more conscious support from MPs in all parties, so that when the final issue came in 1946, I don't think there was much resistance to it at all.
But why couldn't the council get its policy adopted by the wider organisation when they amalgamated then? What What did you mean? What was the objection to having precise objectives in the committee?
No objection at all. Mere waffiness. Mere
just
unwillingness to attach themselves to anything in particular. They were interested in too many subjects. Mm. Started off, as I say, with, I think, horror comics, do you see, in a campaign against horror comics. That was an easy matter because the campaign was already going there. They then went on to dealing with things like adventure playgrounds a good deal, and so on, and just move their minds into fresh sort of fields, but never at any point of time thought out five or six very definite demands for reform. That they could aim at, you see.
I see. I
popularise in the country. You understand?
Yes, I see. I misunderstood you. I thought you were referring to the. You remember that you mentioned these two movements about conservative.
Oh well, that was no.
You're contrasting those two together with the movement concerned with children's comics and so on, which is after the war.
Oh, which is well after the war. Yes, 1952 or 53 or something like that.
Yes, I understand. Yes.
That started off in an international conference in Vienna, at which I was, and so was Simon Yudkin, and we shared a bedroom together, and we cooked up the idea that after the war we'd start a new thing, you see, at that time. Well, the fusion of the two organisations that had lived in sort of easy symbiosis before the war, it was a simple matter when the war approached, you see.
Yes.
There's no difference between us. We simply carried out all sorts of activities. The Committee on Malnutrition was a more of a wide-ranging sort of thing, you see, that held meetings and wrote books on all pamphlets on all sorts of subjects. It wrote pamphlets for things like the Women's Institutes and so on. Pamphlets to be distributed like on the excellence of or the importance of thinking of the nutrition side of the thing, popularly written.
Yes.
And books for the domestic subjects rooms in schools that we wrote at the time.
Yes, what's the relationship between this nutrition movement that you were a member of in the late 30s and the labour movement generally? I mean, are you in alliance or in opposition to the trade union movement, for instance, or to the Labour Party?
Oh, we always got on very well with them.
Did you?
I don't remember any case of any opposition at all.
No, I
knew quite a large number of members of the MPs in sort of, when I say knew them either well or intimately enough.
Because to put it crudely, you're all middle-class people who might not understand the way in which working people live or might be misunderstood by, you know, the labour movement in its working class dimension. Do you see what I mean?
Well, I would say that because I started my political life after the First World War, 1921, by helping with about half a dozen working class men in Holborn to found the Holborn Labour Party. There was no Holborn Labour Party. In many parts of the country at that time, many constituencies, there was no Labour Party. Mm. There were small groups of people who got together and hopefully or hopelessly talked about the possibility of having a Labour Party there. And when I came to live in Holborn, I found this group there and got introduced to it. They were all working class chaps, more or less. I don't think any middle class, but we soon gathered some middle class from here. Adherence, and so we said, we'll form a Holborn Labour Party, all right, and we'll go out canvassing, and we did, and started to gather in fresh members. So I got pretty fair acquaintance with what conditions were like, you know, by going into many homes.
Yes, that's interesting. I was hoping to spark you off by saying that. I mean, the same applies to Eleanor Rathbone, too. I mean, she was involved in social investigation, social work, in a direct way.
She was, yes. Mm.
So that there's not that distance between middle-class reformers and working-class movements that...
Not if the middle-class reformers take it in the right way, do you see?
Yes.
And identify themselves sufficiently with the people for whom they're working and get to understand them. Yeah. But I had nothing much to do, though, with schools occasionally. I don't think I had much to do with maternity and child welfare clinics or anything like that. I just say I knew people in them. Mm. You see, in my organisation, there were people, or there were several women practitioners in the East End at the time who joined it, you see. Very old, curiously Scottish women, probably because one knew another. Yeah. And they were very well acquainted with conditions in their areas, don't you know.
Of course, scientists or doctors are people more likely to know the working class intimately than anybody else, really.
They certainly know pretty well. Mm. Because I would suppose they were all what broadly be called labour.
Mm.